Okay, in our checklist, the things we're looking for when unbelievers urge things against Christianity, we've come to point number three, considering the consequences of unbelief. And I've been looking at the consequences in the university environment, the various departments of the university, and little problems, well, actually big problems, in every one of those particular departments. I'm going to cover a couple of more and then look at culture in general outside the university. In the history department of our universities, those departments that refuse to take a Christian approach to life and to how we understand things, the real issue is there meaning in history at all? And if history is meaningless, that is, if we cannot find a basis for meaning, why should it be studied? What is it that makes certain events important in history and other events not worth mentioning? You probably notice when you read a history book, it doesn't state everything that was going on like during the revolutionary period. We don't read a whole lot about the number of toilets that were available during the revolutionary period. You say, well, that's because that's not relevant, Dr. Bonson. Ah, but how do you know what is and is not relevant if you don't understand what the meaning of history is, or what kind of causality, what brings about certain events in history? What is the nature of historical causality? And our history departments today that do not have a philosophy of life don't have a clue on this matter. In the literature departments of our major universities, the leading critical theory these days, if it can dare be called a theory, is deconstructionism. And the deconstructionist, if nothing else, can be credited for saying we'll have no semblance of a Christian understanding of life, of literature, of meaning at all. And that no semblance of meaning comes down to this. There can be no objective meaning for any text of literature. So that every reading of a text in Shakespeare, in Hemingway, whoever it may be, every reading that is given to that, every interpretation that's given to a text, every reading of a text is a misreading. Because a text cannot have inherent meaning. If it has a set, unchanging, inherent meaning, then that would assume something about the nature of the world that deconstructionists don't want to believe. In fact, deconstructionists come right out and tell you it is a semblance of a Christian view of life that you can read an author and determine his or her meaning. Every reading of a text is a misreading. So that just destroys literary criticism, doesn't it? So we have the destruction of the poli-sci department, the psych department, the physics department, the biology department, the literature department, the sociology department, on and on and on the list could go. And I really do have more notes, but I'm out of time. And on top of all of that, the modern university, not only is there a cancer growing in every department intellectually because the Christian philosophy of life does not inform the approach to biology or literature or history, what have you, but the university as a whole has no center. It has no unity. Originally, the university was called the Uni-versity because there was first diversity. We're going to study history, literature, biology, philosophy, whatever it may be. There's a diversity of departments, a diversity of areas of life that are going to be explored, but there's a unity to the way in which we explore them. And so the world was seen as a universe, and thus the university, the study of how all of life coheres. And what is the unity that originally informed education? It was the Christian worldview. Because we believe in God, His creation, man in his place in the universe, how we know what we know, how we should live our lives, then we can go out with this common perspective and then now specialize in terms of understanding what God has done in the area of, say, music or beauty or literature or history, philosophy, biology, physics, on and on and on. There was a unity to the curriculum, but I guarantee you, unbelievers will say right out, there is no unity to the modern university. It's become a multiversity. And what you hear in one department will conflict with what you hear in another department in terms of their underlying assumptions. Okay, I've really gone through this quickly, but I hope I've given enough illustrations that you get my point. Start looking at the consequences of rejecting the Christian worldview. When people offer you an argument against Christianity, they offer you an argument in favor of some other perspective on life, you have the right to say, and what does this bring about? What does this understanding produce? Look at the fruit that's being produced and ask, is this anything people would want to eat? How many people are satisfied with the modern university and its inability to have foundations in any one department? It just doesn't exist. Well, let's get outside of school setting and real quickly ask about the culture that has been spawned by the non-Christian or the unbelieving worldview. I'm going to look at artistic, political, economic, intellectual, and family culture. Each of these very briefly. Sorry for the machine gun approach, but I'm not really giving extensive argumentation. I'm basically illustrating, so I'm not wearing you down, I hope. Although, it gets tiring listening to people speak like that. Bear with me a minute or two more. First of all, artistic culture. Stop and do an analysis of what the unbelieving world is creating in the area of art these days. Consider musical composition. In most areas of modern musical composition, you will find a defiance of order, harmony, and resolution. And when it's pointed out that people don't want to listen to that kind of music and they don't come to concerts to listen to that anymore, people will then be disdainful of the masses. And what we have really created in our culture are various pockets of musical elitist. And that's true in what might be called the more classical domain. It's also true, by the way, in the rock and roll domain. You know, you'll have people who say, it doesn't matter to us that we're not writing music that communicates with people the masses like. What do they know? They're really quite stupid. In the area of visual art, painting, photography, we have artists who present things which purposely offend in the name of personal liberation, or in some cases, in the name of social liberation. They say, we have the right to offend, to do what we want. So you'll see a crucifix, you know, that's been submerged in urine in a jar or something. And that's supposed to be an artistic sort of thing. You'll see homoerotic art being portrayed. Huge, graphic, photography, and so forth. And if that's deemed offensive, the artist will tell us, yes, but that's the road to liberation. Well, on that basis, why not the Marquis de Sade? Why not that kind of what we call sadomasochistic behavior in the name of liberation? Why not the titillation of snuff films? Who doesn't know what a snuff film is? Okay. A snuff film is one that depicts the murder or mutilation of somebody, usually in the midst of sexual acts. And the film is supposed to, I mean, part of the artistic, isn't that incredible? Part of the artistic uniqueness of this is just that it's not simply an artificial depiction of what it would be like for somebody to die engaged in these kind of perverse sexual acts, but actually having somebody die. Why not, given the modern approach to art that we have in our culture? What is the boundary between decency and indecency, between beauty and ugliness, between art and non-art, for that matter? In our culture, no one can tell anymore. Boy, isn't that a great consequence of an unbelieving approach to the world? Look at political culture. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to notice that we are inundated with self-serving politicians in our day, who are interested primarily in pay raises, which they try to hide from us, engaging in pork barrel legislation, giving their own re-election the highest priority. We no longer have wise statesmen who are concerned for the good of the corporate body. But then on the non-Christian worldview, why not? Why shouldn't politicians be selfish, self-serving, hypocritical creeps, as they usually are? We see double standards all over our political culture. You realize that the Congress that passes the laws by which the rest of the country is to live does not usually bind itself to the rules it imposes on others. It's incredible to me. I'm sure that less than 5% of the population knows that. Congress passes laws about equal opportunity and exempts itself from equal opportunity legislation. Congress passes laws about Social Security taxation and exempts itself from Social Security. Congress passes laws about environmental protection and exempts itself and its properties from environmental protection. But why not? Why should anybody have to be consistent in the non-Christian approach to the world? There are no objective limits to state authority anymore. The state intervenes whenever people think the state should intervene. There is no limit to it. And that, of course, gives rise to unprincipled statism, violations of jurisdiction. The United States goes down to Panama to pick up a dictator and to haul him back, deciding it wants to try this person. Now, I'm not at all sympathetic to Noriega, don't get me wrong. But there are questions of international law and justice involved here. But our country no longer respects them. We have a growing state. We have a state that's doing more and more things. And yet we also have, at the very same time in this glorious non-Christian world, growing criminal activity. Isn't that amazing? The state exists to protect us from crime. And at the very time that the state is doing more and more, getting bigger and bigger, asking for more and more taxes, it's doing an even worse job in limiting crime. Crime is growing at the same time that the state is growing. This is one of the consequences of the non-Christian worldview. Look at our economic culture. We've come to a day in our culture where we have fiat money, and therefore the manipulation of value. What is the value of these things that we hold in our hands called dollar bills and so forth? The value of these things is now determined by political whim. How many dollars will we put out there, float out there? It's a manipulation of value, and who gets hurt by the manipulation of economic value? The people who are most in need of economic health, those who are most in need of economic stability. Who gets hurt by inflation? The aged and the poor. We host shop unions and minimum wage laws which exclude those who need gainful employment from entering into the workplace and competing for the jobs that are available. How does minimum wage do that? Well, there are people who would be willing to work for $3.50 an hour to sweep your floor, but the government says you must pay 4 1/4, no matter who it is. But you don't believe 4 1/4 is what it's worth to have your floor swept by this person, and so he can't get a job. Those people who are most in need of entering into the workplace and competing at the low end of the spectrum to begin rising up cannot enter the workplace then because of minimum wage laws. Mandatory union protection does the same thing. People cannot compete for the jobs that are available. We have legalized theft through taxation. We have legalized theft through inflation because of the decisions made by politicians. In our own personal lives, debt has become a way of life. You'll find a hard time, you'll find it hard to locate people who do not have massive debt. I'm even forgetting that they're paying on their home. Massive debt as a way of life, never known previously. We have an unprincipled use of the system here economically, the savings and loan scandal, $72 billion and growing. Rising unemployment for people that are untrained and poorly educated with little self-discipline. The work that is done in this country is uncompetitive and of apathetic quality. Look at the intellectual culture that's been spawned by unbelief. I've already mentioned the hypocrisy of leading intellectuals. Read Paul Johnson's book, Intellectuals. It's just incredible. The alleged integrity, sensitivity, egalitarianism, and altruism of these men is exposed by the way they lived their lives. Rousseau fathered children all over the place and never provided for them. It's bad enough that he fornicated wildly, But for all of his concern for children and education, he didn't even take care of the own children that he fathered. That kind of hypocrisy among the intellectuals is incredible. We have cutthroat competition in the worlds of science, medicine, and industry that leads to fake and tampered with lab reports, artificial studies being done in order to gain research grants or a place in the market or to win some scientific prize that has money attached to it. Our school system in America is littered with unmotivated teachers, with schools that produce increasingly lower scores, high dropout rates, intense social problems with violence, drugs, sex. This is not hard to do. What do you think? The consequences of the unbelieving approach to life. Pretty impressive, huh? Look at family culture or sexual culture. The world of personal freedom, selfishness, and hedonism in America. More than half of the marriages that take place in our culture today end in divorce. More than half. What does that say about our view of marriage in general? Sexual infidelity, though it is promoted and glamorized in the movies and all the rest, brings with it in our culture personal anguish, pain, despair. Most children in our culture will now experience at some time in their life a broken home, either a home in which they grew up or that they established. Broken homes lead to instability, lead to personal bitterness. We have an increase in child molestation and abuse in this wonderful new world of freedom that the unbeliever has created. We have more than a million unborn babies that are killed every year. And yet we have the hypocritical audacity to condemn Hitler for the Holocaust, where maybe 6 million Jews were killed. We've killed far more than that of helpless unborn babies. We live in a world of promiscuous and perverse sexual lifestyles. And what's it brought about? An uncontrolled AIDS epidemic. Well, I could go on and on. I really could. But by now, I hope you get the point. When the news brings to our attention that somebody who had a religious profession or upbringing went out and killed people or engaged in embezzlement or something like that, I'm not trying to say that should be hidden. I believe in free disclosure and all that. But it really galls me when unbelievers suggest it's religion that creates these problems in our culture. Look all around you. And let's start having a full disclosure as well as a free disclosure. Every time we find people that are guilty of these crimes against humanity and compassion and justice and all the rest, let's remind people, well, that's what unbelief produces after all. It is fair for you to consider when someone raises objections or other lines of consideration against Christianity, it is perfectly fair for you to ask, what would be the consequences if what this person is arguing were true? If this is to be accepted, then what would it lead to? What has it led to? That's another way of doing a check on whether the argument will fly. Well, let me give you a minute to kind of recover from that machine gun blast there. The fourth thing in our checklist will be asking, what are the preconditions of intelligibility for what this person is saying? Now, I realize that's not the language you use out on the basketball court, but you can understand what I'm getting at. The preconditions of intelligibility is a way of summarizing very neatly, asking what sorts of things would have to be true in order for what this person is saying to make sense. What would have to be true about reality? What would have to be true about the way in which we know things? What would have to be true about ethics and human behavior in order for what this person is saying to make sense at all? And when you ask about the preconditions of intelligibility, what you will be driving at, interestingly, is that unless Christianity were true, this person wouldn't even be able to make sense out of what he or she is saying. Okay? Yesterday we looked at a small illustration of that. People will say, miracles are impossible. You say, okay, why are they impossible? Because this universe operates in a law-like, uniform fashion. You say, well, what would have to be true in order to make sense of saying that the universe operates in a uniform, law-like fashion? And in a minute, when I get into my proof of God's existence, I'll be doing this more detail. But for right now, what I told you is, you would have to have a Christian understanding of the universe, a sovereign God who controls all things in a rational and predictable way, in order to say that this universe is just that kind of entity. Therefore, it turns out that those who argue against miracles because everything happens in a law-like predictable way could only make sense of, could only make intelligible those claims if Christianity were first true. The truth of Christianity is the precondition of a uniform universe. And a uniform universe is what is necessary to argue against the possibility of miracles. And therefore, in this line of criticism, which I think is the most effective and the most sophisticated in apologetics, you're basically saying you would have to be sitting on your Heavenly Father's lap before you would be able to slap your Father's face. The precondition of intelligibility for your argument is that Christianity be true, and yet your argument is calculated to show that Christianity is false. So you could only be successful if you were already unsuccessful. Okay? When I debated the atheists at the University of California, Irvine, remember I said, obviously, debate, he wants to debate, he wants things to be logical, he wants to look at the arguments we have and decide who has the best arguments. I said, that's fine. Debate presupposes the laws of logic. But what would have to be true for the laws of logic to make sense? What is the, here's the language that you now understand, what are the preconditions of the intelligibility of the laws of logic? And the answer is, only if Christianity is true could these abstract, universal, and absolute laws make sense. And we're not talking about how they work here. I'm not dealing with what makes it mechanically possible. I'm talking about what makes it intellectually sensible. If you tell me that nothing exists except matter in motion, and then tell me the laws of logic are neither matter nor motion, then you can't have the laws of logic, objective reality that checks the way you reason. And so what I said, basically, I didn't necessarily use this language, but I can summarize it for you. You all understand it now. I basically said, when you came to this debate, the preconditions of the intelligibility of you debating are that you accept the Christian worldview. And yet, ironically, you came here to debate against the Christian worldview. So in order for you to generate your argument, you would first have to be wrong in what you're trying to prove to get anywhere in proving it. Now, that is not ordinarily what you are taught when you study apologetics. That's not usually the way you think, and that's one of the reasons I'm so glad you came to this conference. Because that's the most powerful form of refutation. Asking, what are the preconditions of intelligibility, and showing, and this is what I'm going to be doing here in just a moment, showing that the proof of God's existence, very simply, you want to get this in your notes, trust me. The proof of God's existence, very simply, is that without Him, you couldn't prove anything. The proof of God's existence is that without Him, you couldn't prove anything. To put it very simply, God is the precondition of the intelligibility of all lines of proof. Trying to prove things assumes a certain view of the universe, of how men know what they know and how they should live their lives. And only the Christian worldview can make sense out of those assumptions. Proof itself requires the existence of God to be intelligent. Now, you will probably be a little dismayed to hear that and say, but Dr. Bahnsen, I know lots of people who prove things who say they don't believe in God's existence. And say, that's right. In fact, very interestingly, after I debated Dr. Stein at the University of California, it's a long story, and I know my time is short, and Jane's going to tell me that, so I'm going to be very careful here. I won't tell you how we got into it. We began writing to one another after the debate. And so I challenged him and pushed him further about what his unbelieving worldview could not account for and so forth. And he tried to give answers. And, I'm not saying this because it was just me. I think holes were blown in his arguments. He finally said, okay, I haven't given you adequate answers. But his answer back to me was, either can you. And I said, that's fine. Give me the questions back and I'll answer them. And try to give a Christian approach to these sorts of things. Now, in the process of this correspondence and dialogue with Dr. Stein, I explained to him that unless he had a Christian view of the universe, he wouldn't be able to balance his checkbook. He wouldn't be able to drive a car. He said, you cannot make sense out of balancing your checkbook if you're not a Christian. Please, put on your thinking caps. You're going to get time out a little bit later here. But for right now, think hard. Why would that be? Well, because balancing your checkbook assumes what? First of all, the laws of mathematics. By the way, if the laws of mathematics are arbitrary, you can define them the way you want, then, of course, you don't have to worry about balancing your checkbook. When the bank says, hey, you're out of money, you say, no, I'm not. I've got different laws of mathematics. I'm on the new math. Math that says, I've got all the money I want. Okay, you know very well you can't do that. Balancing the checkbook assumes the objectivity, universality, and abstract nature of the laws of mathematics. But of course, on Dr. Stein's worldview, there are no universal, abstract, and absolute laws of logic, morality, or anything, or math. And so here I'm pushing him again. You've already, in a sense, you now know the argument. It's just going to be, what illustration do you want to take? You're going to hear it over and over and over again. But Dr. Stein wrote back, and he thought, you know, he was being really smart, I guess. He said, well, you may say that I can't balance my checkbook, but I do it all the time. But you see, he doesn't understand the argument at all. And I wrote back and I said, I did not say that you do not balance your checkbook. I said, you cannot make sense out of balancing your checkbook. Because it's my conviction that you do know this God, and therefore you do know that the laws of morality, logic, math, etc. are absolute, and therefore you can be successful in balancing your checkbook. But you could not be successful, and you couldn't even make sense out of balancing your checkbook if you really believed what you say you do about reality, knowledge, and human behavior. So again, don't think that the argument for God's existence is that unbelievers are blithering idiots. They must walk around being illogical and immoral all the time. That's not my point. People are logical. Not completely, but, you know, for the most part, they try to be logical. They do have some kind of morality they live up to or try to. But the point is, if you're not a Christian, you can't make sense out of that. Or as Dr. Van Til used to put it, we're not saying that unbelievers don't count. They know how to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so forth, and 2 times 2 is 4, and all the rest. We're not saying unbelievers don't count. We're saying they can't account for counting. Yes, they do it, but they can't make sense out of it. I believe that unbelievers make moral judgments, and sometimes they're correct, at least formally, outwardly, in their moral judgment. Child molestation is wrong. It's ugly, it's perverse, it's abominable, it's wrong. But when an unbeliever tells me that child molestation is wrong, I have the right to say, can you account for the wrongness of child molestation? I agree with your judgment. You've said the correct thing, but on your worldview, that doesn't make any sense at all. Likewise, unbelievers can do problems in math, balancing their checkbook, but they can't make sense out of it. All of this kind of discussion that I've gotten into, looking at what makes intelligible or makes sense out of what the unbeliever knows and does, is a consideration of the preconditions of intelligibility. Okay, so now this ends the lecture that I had hoped to finish yesterday. Good planning, Dr. Bonson. Anyway, I hope that you will keep this close to you. Every night before you fall asleep, you will read these things and say, tomorrow I will remember better. To consider the arbitrariness, the inconsistencies, the consequences, and the preconditions of the unbeliever's argument. That's how we do apologetics effectively. You want to point out that unbelievers are arbitrary. They have no right to say what they're asserting. Or they're inconsistent. They're contradicting themselves in one way or another. Or the consequences of their arguments are utterly absurd and unwanted. Or that the preconditions of their saying these things are such that they would have to affirm Christianity in order to argue against Christianity. Okay, so let's take a mental recess here. We'll all count to five. Clear the register. And now what I'd like to do is illustrate my fourth point by giving you an argument for God's existence. Now, in light of the time that has been indicated that we have, I'll probably... Now, I think I can be pretty certain, since this is a uniform universe and knowing past experience, I'll not be able to finish this lecture right now. However, fortunately, this lecture breaks into two parts, and hopefully I can get the first part out before you. Essentially, what I'm going to present to you right now is what I give often. It's not the only thing that I do, but when I go to a secular university and some Christian club has asked me to come and to present an argument proving God's existence, that's what I want to do for you. I want to show you, give you an illustration of apologetical argument. It's specifically an illustration of noting that Christianity is the precondition of intelligibility for unbelieving thought and argumentation. However, when you go to a secular university and what's been plastered all over campus are posters that this guy's going to come in and prove the existence of God, hopefully you can understand that there's a lot of preparatory work that has to be done before you actually get to the argument proper. There are a lot of things that have to be understood about the nature of argumentation, theism versus atheism, and so forth. And so those preparatory remarks are what I'll try to cover right now before we take a break and have dinner and so forth. And then when we come back together tomorrow, I will give you the argument proper, if you will, the consideration that if Christianity were true, could we make sense out of our argumentation, our scientific endeavors, and so forth. Time Magazine, April 7th, 1980, published these words. In a quiet revolution in thought and argument that hardly anyone could have foreseen only two decades ago, God is making a comeback in the crisp intellectual circles of academic philosophers. Now, I read that because I would imagine that surprises you, but it's true. We've gone a long time in the 20th century in academic circles and in philosophical circles in particular with the whole idea of theism and Christianity being dismissed and poo-pooed as nobody who's really intelligent can do that. And yet the fact is there's a great deal of attention being given to arguments for the existence of God these days, and as Time Magazine puts it so flippantly, God is making a comeback, as it were. I tell you that because that may surprise you. That's why I've invited you to come to this lecture, because I think that it's not just a matter of God making a comeback. He's always been here, and no one could have argued without him. The crucial question of God's existence points one way or another to the greatest of all illusions. Freud said that the existence of God is the greatest of all illusions, and I think that he's right. One way or another, the question of God's existence is the greatest of all illusions, because if there is no God, then believers in God hold to an imaginary friend. It's a great illusion, like a child who never grew up. But if God does exist, then atheists are living like a child who denies his parents' existence. Atheists are guilty of the greatest of all illusions. And so the question before us today is, who is living in the world of fantasy? Who is guilty of insanity here? And the reason I've come to give this lecture is because I believe in God's existence, and I believe that the existence of God is objectively true, and on top of that, I believe it is objectively provable. I've come to prove the existence of God to you today. I don't pretend that this is the only way it can be done. We don't have time to cover all the ways God's existence might be proven, but I'll give you one important one. The question of the truth of God's existence has nothing to do with the psychology and the character of those who argue one way or another. We must understand that when we ask about the provability of God's existence, we are not talking about the psychology or the character of those who are Christians or those who are atheists. If I happen to have learned algebra from a child molester, is the algebra that I learned invalidated? Obviously not. It may be that those who believe in God have all sorts of terrible things on their moral record. So if anyone wants to bring those things up, I have to point out that's logically irrelevant. The question here is the truth of what they believe, or the falsity of what they believe, not the character of these people. Moreover, the psychology of those who believe has nothing to do with whether God really exists or not. If Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone out of an insane hatred of his postman father, you follow that? Somebody says, well, I'll tell you why he invented the telephone, because he hated his father, and his father was a postman, and he wanted to put the postal service out of business. If that were true, or if Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone with the sordid aim of getting rich and being selfish, would that invalidate the truth of his discoveries and the invention of the telephone? Not at all. Maybe he did hate his father. Maybe he was a guilty, selfish pig. It makes no difference. The telephone was a valid invention. Likewise, the question of God's existence, the truth of God's existence, has nothing to do with the psychology or the character of those who believe in God or those who reject Him. To put it very simply, we must all eschew here what is known as the genetic fallacy in logic. That is, trying to refute something because of its subjective origin rather than on the merits of the case itself. We must all eschew, more broadly, ad hominem arguments, arguments against the man rather than against what he believes and the reasons he offers for it. People will tell you the only reason Dr. Bonson or others like him believe in God is because they're projecting God as a father figure. Well, of course, the first thing that can be said is the biblical God is not the type of God we would project. If I were interested in creating a God that would comfort me, I would not create the biblical God. People who say that just don't understand enough about what the Bible says about God and how uncomfortable it is for all of us, even those who believe in Him. We did not project the existence of God. Here are some common charges made against theism. People will say theism originates in fear. It originates in wishful thinking. As Freud said, our heavenly father is just a substitute for our lost earthly father. People will tell you that belief in God grows out of an infantile dependency. They'll tell you that belief in God distracts from a pleasurable life in this world. You'll that belief in God is nothing but a ploy of hypocritical preachers who want to control their audiences and fleece them for their money. That belief in God is a tool for suppressing the manliness of men and their independence. Or really, belief in God is just an agency for oppressing the minorities, the poor, and women. I mean, I've actually heard people say that women's liberation calls for atheism. That's just a ploy of men to keep women in their place. But now, it's interesting. All such considerations, all of these charges, you must recognize, are reversible. And by the way, are equally subjective and not important ultimately. All these charges I've brought up are reversible charges. How about if I argue this way? Atheism is false because atheism originates in fear of judgment. Atheism originates in wishful thinking about one's personal independence. So atheism is wrong. Or, what if I said, Freud had a bad relation with his biological father, and so he took sublimated vengeance on his heavenly father. Since he hated his earthly father, he took it out on his heavenly father, saying, you don't exist. There's a psychological explanation of atheism. Or I might argue, atheism's wrong because it prevents living life to its fullest. Those who are atheists are full of angst, a generalized brooding fear of life and confusion over the meaning of life. Atheism spawns misery, confusion. Look at the dissipation of the licentious lifestyle of atheists. Look at the brutality of the French Revolution, what have you. Atheism, you see, prevents enjoying life to its fullest. Or atheism is just a tool for justifying statism. Tyrants don't want there to be a God that they'll have to answer to. And so atheists are just saying there is no God so that we can have a statist tyrannical political order. Atheism is a tool for justifying oppression or pragmatic intolerance. After all, Marx and Lenin, both as communists, said that their atheism was crucial to their political theory. Now, what I'm getting at here, very simply, is that every snide reference made by atheists to the Inquisition can be matched by the theist with a reference to the French Revolution or Cambodia or what have you. For every snide reference of the atheist to Puritan strictures or the witch trials of Salem, the theist can match it with reference to the gulags of communism of the Marquis de Sade. For every snide reference to the hypocrisy of a Jim Baker or a Jimmy Swaggart, the theist can match it with reference to the debauchery, the arrogance, and the hypocrisy of atheist intellectuals like Shelley and Byron and Marx and Hemingway and Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre. Because let's remember then, we're not talking about psychology here, and we're not talking about the character of believers in God or unbelievers. And I grant that as we get around to arguing for God's existence, that the existence of God is a very personal question. It's a personal question in the sense that it touches us all deeply and concerns us all in vital ways, especially in the most important aspects of human experience, like the enigmas of who we are as men, personal identity, the enigmas of suffering and evil in this world, love and death. But when I say that the existence of God is a very personal question, I do not mean that it's personal in the sense that it depends on personal feelings. You know, some people personally prefer vanilla to chocolate ice cream. Some people prefer Bach to Bon Jovi. Those are personal issues too. So when I say the existence of God is a personal issue, understand that I mean it's an important issue to the important, personal issues of life, but it is not personal in the sense that it's just a matter of taste. The lecture that I want to offer you, proving the existence of God, is not addressed to that personal mindset which William James called tender-minded, that is, people who are swayed more by personal and subjective factors when they make their philosophical conclusions. People who will look at the utility of that position, or the happiness it will bring, or the comfort, or the need satisfaction factor in what conclusion they will come to. I am appealing to those who believe in God because not such faith comforts them, but rather such faith is unavoidable as an intellectual necessity. If God is a delusion, it's no comfort to believe in Him. Anybody comforted by thinking there's a tooth fairy out there somewhere? The fact that you know there's no tooth fairy is not comforting. Moreover, the lecture that I'm going to offer you and the proofs that I'm going to give you will not convince, in fact, will not even attempt to convince those who refuse to believe in God, because that would hamper their desires and make them unhappy in this world. The existence of an all-knowing God was disgusting to Jean-Paul Sartre. He said he couldn't stand the idea of God looking at him all the time. And so in his autobiography, he says one day he collared the Holy Spirit in the basement and threw him out. I'm not going to try to appeal to people on that basis. It has no relevance whether you like it or dislike it. I'm going to be arguing not about personal desires, not about personal psychology, not about personal character. I'm going to be appealing to the objective truth of God's existence as an unavoidable precondition for the intelligibility of us proving anything at all. Thank you.